Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Wednesday, December 23rd, 2020. Here are some of your headlines. Congressional Democrats now pressing Republicans to boost coronavirus aid stimulus checks from $600 to $2,000 after President Trump's surprise video post Tuesday night calling for that increase. The president saying $600 was ridiculously low. We'll have an update just ahead on what may happen next in Congress. British House of Commons investigates that new coronavirus strain circulating among the population of Britain. We'll check in with the Washington Post London bureau chief about how the country is coping with the challenge. Back in the U.S., President Trump following through on his promise to veto the $740 billion Pentagon spending and policy bill known as the NDAA, or National Defense Authorization Act, a veto override attempt expected next week. President-elect Joe Biden formally introduces his Education Secretary nominee, Miguel Cardona, the current Connecticut Education Commissioner. President Trump departs the White House to spend his final Christmas and New Year's at his Mar-a-Lago Club in Palm Beach, Florida. And today is Attorney General William Barr's final day in that post. Deputy Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen will become acting Attorney General. From USA Today, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi pushing for a Christmas Eve vote on a proposal raising the amount of direct payments included in the just-passed COVID stimulus bill from $600 to $2,000, putting pressure on Republicans to follow President Trump's demand that Congress increase the amount. Speaker Pelosi tweeting, "Let's do it," with an exclamation point. And over in the Senate, the Democratic leader Chuck Schumer tweeting, "I'm in. What do you say, Mitch? Let's not get bogged down with ideological offsets and unrelated items and just do this. The American people deserve it." Mitch referring to the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. But fellow Republican Senator Chuck Grassley on a conference call with reporters says he doesn't think the Senate will go along.
I don't think it is feasible because we are in a situation where we're giving money to some people that haven't lost their jobs. And I think if we do any more, it needs to be more targeted towards those in need.
Senator Chuck Grassley also telling reporters that he hopes President Trump will change his mind about the original bill.
I hope the president will sign the bill or let it go into law without his signature. But also, if more can be done, well, we're told after the new president is sworn in, and it probably will be Biden, then we're going to have another debate like this anyway.
Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican from Iowa, on a teleconference. Associated Press writes, President Trump did not specifically vow to veto the original bill, and there may be enough support for the legislation in Congress to override him if he does. But if Trump were to upend the sprawling legislation, the consequences would be severe, including no federal aid to struggling Americans and small businesses, and no additional resources to help with vaccine distribution. In addition, because lawmakers link the pandemic relief bill to an overarching funding measure, the government would shut down on December 29th. Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, for a few more weeks, still a Democratic U.S. Senator from California, asked by reporters in Washington about the president's call for the increase.
Well, listen, I mean, I think that there's no, you know, I think that we definitely need to get relief. And, I mean, the challenge was, as even the speaker said, they didn't get any feedback from the president. I know that Democrats certainly wanted to get more relief than the $600. And, you know, people are hurting right now. They're hurting. And we need to get the relief to them immediately. And the one thing he should not be doing is, after the work went into the bill, holding up when by the end of the month, their benefits are going to end.
That's Vice President-elect and Senator Kamala Harris with reporters in Washington. On the phone now, Alex Bolton, congressional reporter with The Hill. Thanks for being with us. Let's talk about what may happen tomorrow in the House. Set that up for us.
Well, tomorrow morning, Speaker Nancy Pelosi is going to offer a unanimous consent request to pass standalone legislation that would increase the total amount of the direct stimulus checks to $2,000 per person, which is what President Trump is calling for. That's a substantial increase over the $600 direct stimulus checks currently in the COVID relief under the spending bill that has passed the House and the Senate and is on its way to Trump. It's also significantly more than the $1,200 direct stimulus checks that was included in the CARES Act and that was part of the HEROES Act that the House passed in May and part of the HEALS Act, the joint White House Senate Republican proposal offered in July. So Pelosi is going to offer a unanimous consent. The question now is what happens? There was a conference call around 3 o'clock with the House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy and the House Republican Conference. And McCarthy said that he is working on his own unanimous consent request that would, remains to be seen exactly what it'll do. So it is kind of a mystery as to, you know, exactly how this plays out on the Senate floor. On the House floor. However, McCarthy on this call did indicate that he is in Trump's corner. So this may then, if this does pass, it gets kicked over to the Senate, and then it'll be up to perhaps Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, who objected the last time there was a request for unanimous consent on the floor to boost up the stimulus checks.
And to clarify, even if anything passes the House tomorrow, the earliest the Senate could take it up would be when?
Well, if depends what we're talking about. We're talking about a plus up of the stimulus checks. I mean, that would be done by unanimous consent. And there is, there is a pro forma session in the Senate scheduled for December 24th. So you could do it, seek unanimous consent on the Senate floor during that pro forma session, or you could wait until the next pro forma session, which is December 28th. And if you don't get it then the Senate is due to come in for morning business on the 29th, and possible votes then to override Trump's veto, which was just delivered to the House today, of the National Defense Authorization Act. But the pro forma session on December 24th is 10 a.m. So it's going to be, I think, pretty quick work to organize a UC by 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, although I guess you could keep that pro forma session open longer than usual to try to work something out. But, this is all moving very, very quickly. And, there hasn't been any communication right now from the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell as to what he wants. There was some communication that McCarthy had with his members on the conference call. There were leaks from that conference call, but that call was cut short. So it's not entirely clear what McCarthy's plan is either, only that he indicated that he is supportive of what the president wants. Maybe that's not a big surprise, and that he's working on his own unanimous consent agreement. And so, there's news breaking now that the House GOP is poised to block Pelosi's bid for $2,000 relief checks.
We're talking with Alex Bolton, congressional reporter with The Hill. While all that is going on, if nothing were to pass that's brand new, we go back to the original coronavirus aid and regular government funding bill, which has not yet even arrived at President Trump's desk. What are the scenarios with that?
Well, I mean, this is a 5,593-page bill that takes a while to enroll. And right now, the estimate is that it gets to the president by Thursday or Friday. And so if the president wants, he can just sit on that bill. The Constitution gives him 10 days, not including Sundays, to take action on the legislation. So if he doesn't do anything, then after those 10 days elapse, we're going to be into January, and there's going to be a new Congress, which means that this bill will fail and there won't be any opportunity to override it. But I understand that the president hasn't yet made his decision, the final decision, on vetoing the relief package and on the spending package, although he threatened to do so on Tuesday night.
Follow the work at thehill.com. Alex Bolton, congressional reporter, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And follow the House live on Thursday, 9 a.m. Eastern on C-SPAN television, right here on C-SPAN Radio. Listen anywhere on the free C-SPAN Radio app. And the Senate is always live as well on our free app and on C-SPAN 2 television, and they all stream at cspan.org. Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky opposed the original package, $2.3 trillion total, coronavirus aid, $900 billion, and then the regular government spending bill for the full fiscal year, $1.4 trillion. Senator Paul asked today on Fox News whether he would support President Trump's veto, if it came to that, over the president's desire to increase spending on direct payments to Americans.
If the president does veto this legislation, will you vote to override?
You know, the thing is that I hope he vetoes it, but the only way I would vote for any spending or any additional spending is if it came out of existing spending. So if they want to cut the $30 billion we shovel and send overseas, I'm happy to vote for that, and we can discuss where we can spend it here in our country. I think there are a lot of things. I think giving money, though, to people who are already working. Look, my kids are working and don't need the check. They're not rich, but they don't need a check. And most working Americans don't need a check right now. It's a really foolish, egg-headed, left-wing socialist idea to pass out free money to people. So I part ways with the president on giving people free money. We should help those who are unemployed by extending unemployment, but we shouldn't add to unemployment. There are things we can do. Look, in 2008, President Obama extended unemployment. They didn't juice it up by giving people more money not to work than they were. So we've done a lot of terrible ideas that are much worse than what we criticized President Obama. President Obama is now a conservative when it comes to stimulus because his unemployment didn't juice it up. He just extended it. We didn't give cash payments back then. But the cash payments is a ridiculous, terrible, foolish, no good idea because you're just printing out money to give to people. Why not do it all the time? Give people 1,000, 10,000, why not a million? It's a terrible idea and it's going to ruin the value of our currency ultimately.
Senator Rand Paul, Wednesday morning on Fox News. Senator Paul also publishing today his annual Festivus Grievances Report, with a focus on what he says is wasteful government spending. In this report, he got it down to the penny, $54,746,524,505.37. Festivus, you know, might know, popularized in the 1997 Seinfeld episode focusing on the secular holiday. On Wall Street today, the Dow was up 114, NASDAQ down 36, S&P up 2. Labor Department says the number of Americans seeking unemployment benefits fell last week by 89,000 to a still high 803,000. And from the Commerce Department, personal incomes in November fell 1.1%, while consumption dropped 0.4%. President Trump Tuesday night also is issuing a slew of pardons. One of the people he pardoned was former Republican Congressman Duncan Hunter, who told a TV station in San Diego this morning he was surprised to get the news.
I was making some Christmas cookies with my 14-year-old daughter last night, and my phone started blowing up. I thought that someone had died. I had no idea what was happening.
So
and this came through.
So you didn't go through White House channels. This is just something that happened from being well-connected?
Yeah.
Or how'd it play out?
No. Out of the blue, I mean, we helped a lot of guys, guys like Eddie Gallagher, the Navy SEAL that the Navy tried to kick out, guys like him that were close to Trump and people in that circle, mostly military folks, I think. There were some congressmen, the article said, that helped me out. Don't know who they are, but thank you. But I'll tell you what, the Blackwater guys, when you say that they were involved in a civilian shooting, they were involved in a firefight by Iraqis, by terrorists in Baghdad, and they were framed by the Obama administration. So thank God that Trump pardoned those four guys. You had a contractor protecting the Department of State personnel put in jail for life for protecting him in a firefight. So, I mean, those guys deserve this pardon way more than me.
That's where I want to go, because you could make a Papadopoulos and Flynn. I mean, you could make an argument they were railroaded. Pardons are supposed to be for those who get railroaded by the legal system. But that's not you, is it? I mean, or do you feel like you were railroaded?
Oh, absolutely. My two prosecutors went to a Hillary Clinton fundraiser months before they indicted me. I mean, these are actual Democrat politicians that happen to be prosecutors that have the full weight of the U.S. government behind them. And I'll tell you, God help anybody who gets in the way of the U.S. government. So stay squeaky clean. Make sure your taxes are perfect, because you don't want the U.S. government coming after you with a political agenda. As President Trump knows, you don't want that to happen to you, or they will use their entire might to try to put you in jail, just like they did to President Trump with that baloney impeachment process.
Former Congressman Duncan Hunter, Republican from California, this morning on KUSI-TV in San Diego, one of 15 people pardoned Tuesday night by President Donald Trump. He mentioned some of the others, four former Blackwater security guards convicted of a 2007 massacre in Baghdad, leaving more than a dozen Iraqi civilians dead. George Papadopoulos was mentioned, a former campaign aide to President Trump, who was convicted of lying to investigators about his contact with individuals tied to Russia during the 2016 campaign. Also getting a pardon, another former congressman, and that is Chris Collins of New York, another Republican. He was pardoned and released from federal prison Tuesday night. He had pleaded guilty last year to conspiracy to commit securities fraud and lying to the FBI, began serving a 26-month sentence mid-October. Back in a minute with more Washington Today. Welcome back to Washington Today. A few more headlines. Pfizer and BioNTech have signed a second agreement with the U.S. government to supply an additional 100 million doses of their COVID-19 vaccine by the end of July 2021. The government also has the option to buy an additional 400 million doses. And a new poll indicating Americans are more willing to take a coronavirus vaccine. 46% in the USA Today's Suffolk University survey say they intend to take the vaccine at the earliest available opportunity. That's up 20 percentage points from a similar poll in late October. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo again urging the federal government to take steps to protect the U.S. from a new variant of the coronavirus that's been spreading in the United Kingdom. Cuomo said the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is repeating the mistakes of this past spring, when the original strain of the virus spread from Europe to New York and other Northeast U.S. states before travel restrictions were imposed. Here's Governor Cuomo in Albany.
The issue of the new strain is very serious, and I don't believe this country is taking it as seriously as it should. And more importantly, I don't think this country is taking the action that it should take, okay? So let's just talk facts first. Fact, it is in the UK and it is more dangerous. Boris Johnson says it's 70% more transmittable. Boris Johnson closed parts of the UK. Other European countries have banned travel from the UK. But it is more dangerous. How much more dangerous? We don't know. We don't know if it's more deadly. We don't know if the vaccine works on it or not. We think the vaccine works on it. That's our quote-unquote working assumption. But it is real and it is dangerous. It is traveling around the world as we speak, right? It's on planes. And it is transmitting, and other people are getting on planes, and it's the holiday season, and it is traveling around the world. That is a fact. It's not a personal opinion. 120 countries now require testing before people leave the UK or ban people from the UK. That is not a personal opinion. That is a fact. Number four, France went so far as to stopping truck traffic from the UK, caused massive backups by stopping the traffic coming into France. That's how seriously France took it. And then you have federal officials in this country who say, well, it may be here already. Okay? Those are five inarguable facts. When you hear those facts, you have to say to yourself, what? What happened? And what are we doing? And why are we not doing what 120 other countries that are far less sophisticated, that paid far less of a price for COVID, that didn't have the experience that we had? Why aren't we saying test the travelers in the UK before they get on a plane?
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo at Wednesday's coronavirus briefing in the capital city, Albany. In London, the British House of Commons Science and Technology Committee held a hearing about this new coronavirus mutation. Testifying, Dr. Peter Hornby, the UK new and emerging respiratory virus threats advisor. This is the question from the committee chair, Conservative Party Member of Parliament, Greg Clark.
We know that COVID now has over 1,700 variants that have been isolated and made known. What is special about the one that has occupied the attention of you and your colleagues in recent days?
Good morning, everyone. I mean, just for a bit of background, as you said, your viruses do mutate. And so you see substitutions in the genetic code, which can lead to changes in the proteins, which can lead to changes in the behavior of the virus, which is why we monitor the genetic code of the viruses. And like all other viruses, you know, this virus does mutate. And so over the year, we've seen many different variants arising. The vast majority don't have any material change on the way the virus behaves, but we need to keep monitoring it. And the UK probably has one of the best sort of genomic monitoring systems in place. It's a system called COG-UK, just in case we refer to it later, which is the genomics consortium. And it sequences about 10% of all positive samples in the UK. And so this variant became of interest because there was an investigation of the increase in case numbers in Kent in early December, despite the national lockdown. And when Public Health England went in to investigate why there was this increase, they looked at the genomic data and they saw a cluster, an unusual cluster of a previously not recognised variant of the virus. Now, Professor Bartley can talk more about this, but it was unusual in that it had many, many mutations, not just one or two, but there were 23, I believe, genetic mutations leading to quite a few changes in the proteins. And some of them in the what we call the receptor binding domain, which is where the virus binds to the cell to infect it, which could affect the behavior of the virus. As NervTag, we heard about this on the 11th of December. So PHE first heard of it on the 8th, and they put in a paper, an ad hoc paper, to a routinely scheduled NervTag meeting on the 11th of December about this variant that they'd discovered and their concerns about it. At that stage, on the 11th of December, we said this was of concern, and we endorsed all of the measures that PHE were doing to find more information. But at that stage, there was considerable uncertainty, and the data was really observational. There was an increase in cases in southeast England, London. There was an increase in this variant. But whether they were causally related was really unclear. So 1 week later, we looked at the emerging evidence. That was on the 18th of December. And that was where we really looked at three strands of evidence. One was the epidemiology, which was clearly showing that despite the national lockdown, the cases had been increasing in Kent and London and the east of England, and that increase was associated both in time and place with a rapid increase of this virus variant. It was overtaking all the other virus variants. And it happened in a way which suggested it started in Kent, you know, from probably one person and then expanded. We've had other variants that were due to importations from overseas, so multiple importations, say, from Spain in the summer. And so you see different hotspots lighting up, but this looked like it came from a point source. So the fact that it was this point source and that it, even during lockdown, it was increasing rapidly and increasing much more rapidly than other viruses suggested that it might have some biological advantage over the other viruses.
A portion of today's Science and Technology Committee hearing in the British House of Commons, with more on how Great Britain is dealing with the coronavirus variant and what it means for the United States and the rest of the world. Joining us now from London is William Booth, London Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Thank you very much for being with us. This week began with France blocking trucks from Great Britain, raising concerns about food shortages. You've been reporting that there's been a breakthrough on that.
Yes, there has. There are still 40 to 50 travel bans against the UK, meaning mostly for flights, for air passengers leaving from Britain to go other places because of this mutation in the virus. So those are still mostly holding, though those could free up a little bit. But the French blocked the port, or the ports, plural, that would bring goods back and forth via like trailer and train and the Eurotunnel between England and France. And that got held up from Sunday night until really just a few hours ago this afternoon.
What kind of effect have the travel restrictions been having on the economy?
Well, on the economy, probably just more of a hiccup than a big problem. But, you know, grocery stores, major grocery stores in Britain reported some panic buying, and they also were advising some customers in some places, you know, that they would have a limit on the amount of eggs and toilet paper and the rice they could buy. So it had an effect on the economy a little bit. And also, you know, Santa's making these deliveries, which you might know, and not all of them come by sled. So that's been a problem, too.
How locked down is Great Britain, and how has the emergence of this new virus variant changed that?
Well, a lot of Britain, a lot of the all of London and a lot of the south and southeast of England is in pretty much virtual complete lockdown like it was twice before. I live in London. I'm ordered not to leave my house except to go grocery shopping or to the pharmacy or a medical appointment or get my, you know, an hour of exercise outdoors a day. So, you know, we're in lockdown here, what they call tier four. And that affects about 18 million people in a country of 67 million. And then another 10, 12 million are going to enter this tier four probably right after Christmas. So it's affecting the UK a lot. I mean, this spreading variant has concerned the government and has put us all back in our homes.
When it comes to the United States, there's varying degrees of lockdown, but they're not really enforced. You said there it is quite enforced. Has there been any public pushback?
Yes, there's been a lot of public pushback in the sense that there's not big noisy demonstrations on the street, though there have been those in the past. But the British public is very upset with the on-again, off-again nature of these restrictions. Boris Johnson said earlier that it would be, you know, inhumane to cancel Christmas, and then he kind of half canceled Christmas, right? So people are upset, and, you know, people make plans. You know, people live on one side of England or another, and they think, well, we're going to go gather at mom's house or grandma's house or the kid's house, and then, you know, make plans, and then all that gets, you know, knocked over at the last minute. People spend money on flights and plans, and so there is a lot of grumbling about this. I mean, I guess, you know, most people sort of understand it. We're in a pandemic, but they don't like how the government has done it with this last minute on again, off again stuff. They're unhappy about that. That's pretty clear.
We're talking with William Booth, the Washington Post, London bureau chief. And vaccine distribution. Britain was about a week or so ahead of the U.S. in approving the Pfizer vaccine. Where are things in getting people the shots? And also, is the Moderna vaccine approved there?
Yes. So wave the Union Jack. We beat you there by a week. Britain approved it a week earlier, the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine, which is being distributed here. There's about 500,000 doses have been distributed and given in the UK as of a day or two ago. They were hoping to get a few million more by the end of the year, but that's uncertain. So they're going off great guns there on the Pfizer vaccine. And people have been lining up to get that, mostly the elderly and frontline healthcare workers. Moderna here has not been approved. We just heard today that the AstraZeneca Oxford University vaccine, which appears to be slightly or more or less efficacious than the Pfizer one, they have submitted their full data set to the health regulators here today. So we might have a decision in the UK on AstraZeneca, which is cheaper and pretty efficient, in days to come, in a week or soon.
And finally, Brexit. The trade deal negotiations have been complicated by the coronavirus pandemic. Where are things on that?
Brexit, I don't know what you're talking about. What's this Brexit thing that you mentioned? Oh, yeah, right, Brexit. Okay, yes. The UK is supposed to leave in December 31st, in 7 or 8 days from now, and they are still going to the wire in their talks. There's word as of this evening here that there might be a deal announced from Brussels and London, but we don't have a deal yet. And so all eyes are on, you know, whether they get a trade and security deal, you know, that lets Britain leave the EU with some sort of reasonable trade and security arrangement, or whether it just, quote unquote, crashes out and has to go to World Trade Organization, WTO rules. And those WTO rules would mean, you know, high tariffs and lots of scrutiny of meats and vegetables and other products. So no one really wants that.
William Booth, London Bureau Chief for The Washington Post in London. Read his work at WashingtonPost.com. Thank you very much.
Anytime, my friend. Happy to do it.
And returning to the U.S. and the response to the coronavirus, this from the Associated Press. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf on Wednesday proposed spending $145 million in a workers' compensation fund to help businesses cope with the coronavirus pandemic. The Democratic governor's plan requires a vote from the Republican majority legislature to appropriate the money, and there has been no deal to accomplish that. Wolf said he wants the money to go out in the form of grants to businesses that have been most harmed by the COVID-19 pandemic, among them restaurants, bars, and gyms. During an online news conference, Wolf said people were worn out by the pandemic, even as vaccines are starting to be administered. That all from Associated Press. Here is part of the governor's news conference.
If you could just take a moment just to speak to a cafe out there, an ice cream shop, a hairdresser, you know, those folks who are watching you right now all across Pennsylvania, and, you know, we're here in Western Pennsylvania in the Pittsburgh area. What do you, as the governor, want to say about getting through the next few months and, you know, these folks who are trying to pay their employees and keep folks on the payroll and, you know, continue to function after we kind of have this behind us? What do you want to say to them specifically?
Well, the first thing is what I've been saying, and that is that this pandemic has imposed horrible choices on all of us. You know, each of us as individuals have had to make decisions about our own personal safety, the safety of our families, the health of our families, and our economic well-being. And they have been really awful choices. And as I keep saying, it's not the fault of, say, restaurant owners or bar owners or gym owners that their business is conducted in places where people actually gather together. That's what the virus likes, but it's not the fault of those owners. And unfortunately, because that's what the virus likes, we're all subject to the dictates of that virus, and it has made life hard for all of us, but especially hard for those businesses, for the workers, for the owners, for the patrons who rely on these places, and it has been really tough. What I'm trying to do here, and what I've been trying to do, is say let's figure out a way to address both of these things. We can't ignore reality. We can't ignore the fact that this virus is out there. It is. I hate that. I'm sure everybody hates it. It frustrates all of us. We're all fatigued, but it is out there. That's the reality. So how can we make the, you know, living with this reality as palatable as possible? And I think the only thing I can think of is do what this $145 million is focused on doing. I'm hoping the General Assembly will agree to get this money into the hands of those businesses, those folks who need it the most. Hopefully this next round of CARES Act funding will bring even more money. And again, what's different now than was what we had back in the spring is back then we didn't know when this was going to end or how it was going to end. Now we see vaccines. There's a light at the end of the tunnel. And I going to do everything I can, and Pennsylvanians are going to do everything they can to make sure that those vaccines get out as quickly and as effectively as possible. But in the meantime, we have to figure out what we're going to do until we get that magic, whenever that magic time is, when that light is on us, and enough people have the vaccine that we don't have to worry about this virus anymore. We're still some months away from that. We know it's coming, and we'll bring it as quickly as possible. But I think what we need to do is figure out how we survive, how we thrive between now and then. And that's what I'm trying to do with this $145 million. I know that's what Congress is trying to do with this round of CARES Act funding. The hope is that we can make it to that great time when all of us have access to the vaccine.
Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf. Some Republican state lawmakers have been critical of the governor for imposing restrictions on businesses during the pandemic. Dave Zimmerman, who represents the Lancaster area, telling AP, with any kind of plan to bail out restaurants, we need to get them back into business so they can help themselves going forward as well. It's got to be a two-tiered approach. President-elect Joe Biden formally introducing his nominee for Secretary of Education today. Miguel Cardona is currently Connecticut's Education Commissioner. Biden calling Cardona brilliant, qualified, and tested, who will be ready to oversee the reopening of the nation's public schools amid the COVID-19 pandemic.
Once again, during this pandemic, we've seen who our educators are. They're selfless, they're dedicated. They're cut from a true cloth of character and commitment. They represent one of the most critical professions in America, and that's not hyperbole, that's a fact. From cradle to career, they give people of all ages the confidence to believe in themselves, to equip them to succeed. And as Jill says, any country that out-educates us is going to out-compete us. In this critical moment of our nation's history, it's essential that there is an educator serving as Secretary of Education. I want to make that clear again. An educator, someone who's taught in the classroom, comes out of the classroom. Today, I'm pleased to announce that such a nominee we have, Dr. Miguel Cardona. Like other cabinet nominees and appointees, he's brilliant, he's qualified, and he's tested. And he's going to join the Biden-Harris cabinet, and it's going to be a historic cabinet. Already, there are more people of color in this cabinet than any cabinet in the history of the United States. There are more women than ever. First openly gay cabinet member. It's a cabinet that looks like America. It taps into the best of America. That opens doors and includes the full range of talents we have in this nation. And like the rest of the team, Dr. Cardona is ready on day one. Vice President-elect Harris and I, we're going through this, and we were doing it on Zoom, who we're going to pick. And we're getting all this advice, and we looked at each other in the room and said, no, it's Cardona. It's real easy. So Vice President-elect knew we needed an education secretary who truly understands what it's been like for educators, administrators, families, caregivers, and students this past year. They worry. They're under stress. They stretch local budgets that have left educators out of work. There's mixed signals from the White House that have left more confusion than calm. And they left so many parents and schools feeling like they're on their own. But we also need someone who knows what it's like, what it takes to get through this crisis. Reopening schools safely will be a national priority for the Biden-Harris administration.
President-elect Joe Biden in Wilmington, Delaware. His nominee for Education Secretary, Miguel Cardona, began his career as an elementary school teacher in Connecticut and then served as a school principal for 10 years before becoming Connecticut's Commissioner of Education.
Though we are beginning to see some light at the end of the tunnel, we also know that this crisis is ongoing, that we will carry its impacts for years to come, and that the problems and inequities that have plagued our educational system since long before COVID will still be with us even after the virus is gone. So it's our responsibility, it's our privilege to take this moment and to do the most American thing imaginable. to forge opportunity out of crisis, to draw on our resolve, our ingenuity, and our tireless optimism as a people, and build something better than we've ever had before. That's the choice Americans make every day. It's a choice that defines us as Americans. It's the choice my grandparents made, Avelino and Maria de la Paz Cardona and Germana Muñiz Rosa, when they made their way from Aguada, Puerto Rico, for new opportunities in Connecticut. I'm proud to say I was born at the Yale Lakers housing projects. That's where my parents, Hector and Sarah Cardona, instilled early on the importance of hard work, service to community, and education. I was blessed to attend the public schools in my hometown of Meriden, Connecticut, where I was able to expand my horizons and become the first in my family to graduate college and become a teacher, a principal, an assistant superintendent in the same community that gave me so much. That is the power of America. And I, being bilingual and bicultural, am as American as apple pie and rice and beans. For me, education was the great equalizer. But for too many students, your zip code and your skin color remain the best predictor of the opportunities you'll have in your lifetime.
Miguel Cardona, nominated for Education Secretary, along with President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris today in Wilmington, Delaware. Now, just under a month until the presidential inauguration, a few of the Biden cabinet positions that he has not named people to include Justice Department, the Attorney General, also Secretaries of Labor and Commerce, and the CIA Director. Thanks for joining us on Washington Today. Download the free C-SPAN radio app, and remember this program and other C-SPAN programs available as podcasts. Find them wherever you get your podcasts. Hope you have a good night, and as always, stay safe.